Macaulay, we are at my house in San Pedro, and I'm interviewing Stan Weir. Stan, what did you? We stopped it after you had lost your longshore job. What did you do next?
I got a job driving a truck for a hospital rental stuff, beds and oxygen tanks, things like that. And I had injured my back the last day I was in the waterfront, and would have been very difficult to get anything done about it. And it had been getting better. But I picked up one of the large tanks. They're about 5 feet to 6 feet long. Put it on my shoulder, and I walked to the back of the truck to give it to my partner, the swamper. And my back went out, and that oxygen tank went flying right out the truck. We were on a hill, parked. And it went right over his head, about 6-7 inches. And I got down, we put the tank back in the truck, and we drove right to the dock, the company. And I quit right then and there. I told them, I said, there's nothing, you know, no injury on this job. I had a previous injury, and I almost just killed this man, and that's the end of that. And they said, but God, we need you, and you're doing a great job here. And I said, that back goes out again, I might kill someone next time. So I got a job at Eichler Homes in Palo Alto.
Didn't you consider filing a workman's comp suit against the longshore? Or?
I was sick and tired of dealing with those people. I didn't want to see them. I didn't want to have to deal with them on anything else but this case. And so I just wrote it out on the back, with the back. And Ned Eichler, Paul Jacobs got me this job at Eichler Homes. And I was the guy who bought heavy equipment, construction equipment, and then did a study on when to sell, when do we amortize it, what's the best time to sell equipment of this kind off. And I was there, while I was working there, I wrote an article on the case, the first really detailed article on the case for New Politics, called The ILWU, A Case Study in Bureaucracy, Parts 1 and 2. And Part 1 in particular was an indictment, and it was well done. And Ned Eichler somehow read this article, the president of the corporation, a young man. And he came to me after I had worked there about a year and said, I just got a large grant from the Ford Foundation to build medium-density, low-cost housing for auto workers on a model basis, trial basis, just an experiment. And the auto workers are in they're now in Fremont, California, but that's the local, same local that you're a member of. So you're ideal for this job. Come with me, you will run the construction. You can't be BS'd by town fathers. You're middle class enough for that. You can't be BS'd by union leaders. You're working class enough for that. You can write. Let's go. So suddenly I was on the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley as a research associate, step 3, and was spending a lot of time in Fremont, California, and around the plant doing research.
What connection did Eichler have with the University of California?
Well, you can't have a grant from any foundation and you administer the funds. You got to go to a university and have the university administer the funds. So you got Cal to administer the funds. So there we were on the faculty, and it was the free speech movement year.
Is that 1968?
64, 65. And it was magnificent. What a year.
Did did you get involved in like the free speech movement at all? Did you listen to people?
Oh, every day, and I was used as kind of an advisor or consultant or something by the movement.
Did you know Mario Savio?
Oh yeah, all those guys. Jack Weinberg, better. He was the guy in the car over which the whole thing got started.
Oh.
I mean, the whole sit-in of Sproul Hall, because he was a captive in the car. There was a sit-down strike around a police car in which he had been shoved by cops, and they couldn't move the car.
The police had come to break up a student
rally in front of Sproul Hall. So Jack Weinberg wound up joining the IS. International Socialist, or before that, the Berkeley Socialist Club. And we got to know one another very well. But before that year was up, I had gone to a sociology convention in San Francisco, ASA, American Sociology Association. And I met a guy I had known years before, who is now a professor at, then a professor at, Northern Illinois University, and he said, God, you're just the guy I need for this study. We're going to compare, well, I have a National Science Foundation grant, we're going to compare British and American unions for what in their constitution creates or does not create competition for the top three offices, and you'll run the American side of it, and you'll interview 60 the top officers of 60 international unions in America. And you'll live in Washington, D.C., and you'll report to a computer in Champaign-Urbana. So I interviewed about 58 presidents of international unions in Washington, D.C., and a few other places. And while I was feeding the computer one day toward the end of that year, at the University of Illinois, they said to me, gee, we got a job coming up. You're just ideal for the job. It's teaching grievance and collective bargaining skills to union officers, from students up to, say, local and regional officials, heads of various unions, at those levels.
Was there any question about your credentials for teaching those classes?
I knew two guys in the faculty. Archie Green was one of them. Mm-hmm. He was there, right there. He said, "My God, what are you doing here?" I said, "You know." So he, of course, pushed for me for getting on the faculty, and I was known already in Otto, and they'd read some of my stuff about the case, and I didn't even fill out an application.
It wasn't required that you have a degree to teach the
course. It was, but they didn't ask me, and I didn't think to say anything. Mm-hmm. So, when you're a member of faculty, you know, paperwork from the university itself keeps coming across your desk, and you got to sign and put down your degrees and so on. And I kept putting HSG. And finally, the executive secretary of the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations, which is where I taught, came to me and said, "Professor Weir, what's this HSG?" I said, "High school graduate." I had picked this up from Paul Jacobs, who taught at Cal, and the same thing happened to him, in effect, only not quite as his boss knew he'd never been to college. But they finally, the higher-ups. So she didn't even laugh. There was she didn't see the humor in this. So the director came to me and said, "Stan, now you're doing a good job here, but if you're going to stay and get tenure, we want you to, you got to have a higher degree." And I told him, "There's no way I'm going to go. I got 16 good units from before World War II, if they're still good." And because I was in junior college much of the time, mm-hmm. because of revised curriculum, mm-hmm. which we discussed. And he said, "Well, let me think about this." And he went and he came back to me and he said, "What if I can get you in graduate school on probation, direct?" I said, "You got a deal." Because I was working full-time 60 hours a week, I couldn't go undergrad. But I could take one graduate course a semester. I could handle that. And that would be 3 years. 2 years if I did it two summer sessions. So I figured 2 years for that, and another year and a half to write my thesis, and hey. So he went to the head of the university, and they hemmed and hawed, and he says, you're doing this sort of thing right now for blacks, aren't you, on the basis of their experience out in society? I said, yeah. How about doing it for a white guy? So the blacks got me into graduate school. It was 1968. It was black power was a big thing, and they were making concessions to blacks who hadn't had all the formal background and education to get into graduate school, and they really and truly they got me in. Mm-hmm. And
Go ahead.
Well, my job was I'd say 90%. 75% of my job was to conduct 8-week courses in the field. I was given a university car, which I would check out every time I left town, turn it back in when I returned to town. And I would set up 8 weeks courses with the glass bottle blowers, local in some central Illinois town, La Salle, Peru, for example. And I would meet with them 8 consecutive Tuesday nights and Wednesday mornings. If they had 3 shifts, I would have the 2 classes on that. And these were non-credit courses, which was phony. It should have been for credit, at least toward an AA. And that meant that I was teaching 4 locals at a time. I would go to 4 different local unions a week for 8 weeks, and then while I was doing that, I'd be setting up the next 8-week period.
And you saw 4 nights a week.
Yeah, mornings and nights usually, or noons and nights. Mm-hmm. And you had to set them up so that they were geographically close enough together so you didn't have to drive too far. Or you're always behind the 8-ball. You never get a chance to prepare for the next course the next following morning or the following evening. And that meant that in the regular semester period, I was dealing with at least 12 more, at least 16 different locals in 8 weeks courses in a year's time. And in the summertime, we stayed in the universities, and unions sent us workers, stewards usually, in multiples of 30. Steel workers would send us 90 to 120 every summer. And they stayed all week. They came Sunday night, and they left the following Saturday noon. And
Sometimes. Some of the areas that that the course covered?
Grievance bargaining was the biggest single item. In that area, it also meant, of course, in leadership. I always taught the course in such a way as to get people into the business of learning how to get out of the grievance procedure and into direct action, away from arbitration. And it was very effective. And it was there that I began to develop real materials, handouts, the whole thing, books on informal work groups and on your rights in the workplace as compared to the Constitution. Bill of Rights. And that became the backbone of the whole bargaining course. So it wasn't simply just how to litigate a grievance. A lot of locals negotiate their own contracts. The total thing. Maybe with the aid of a business agent or an international rep. But we became the pro tem international reps, education directors of many locals, because usually every local is divided into at least two factions, sometimes three. And no member of any faction can teach that course. The international union is siding with one of the factions. Nobody from their offices can teach a course. Only an outsider who does, they know, doesn't know anything about the politics, who teaches everybody without prejudice at one time. And so the locals that we were called into or wanted us most were usually the locals most in conflict with their international unions. I really learned a lot from this.
How much control did you have over the course content?
I would say that I had 100% control, but I always exercised constraints upon myself. That is, you don't want to lead them into areas of argument in which we're getting now, the class is going to be interrupted by the presence of some international rep who's going to come in and argue with you or on and on. You want the class to prepare people to conduct that argument themselves.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, did you ever have any experiences with international people complaining about course content? Never bumped
heads? A few times. Not a lot, because I stayed away from Chicago, where all the bureaucrats were. I always volunteered for the locals that were in Carroll, Illinois, Anna, East St. Louis, Alton, the river towns, all the Mississippi river towns, Danville, right on the Indiana border, that kind of Paris. All when you're that far away from Chicago, there is nobody around from the International Union. Those people are out there on their own, and you're the only one who's interested in them. And they listen to you. They give you a chance. And you get to know, though, that you better give them something the first night of the class that they can use the following morning. And if you're successful at that, you have to start telling them, don't go back to the plant tonight with this. Think it over. Assimilate it. And you have marvelous experiences with this kind of teaching.
Because
then you learn what happened the next week and
yeah, right.
On and on.
Yeah. And I assume that when dealing with a course like that, you fall back a lot on your own life experience. And
oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the guys would take things from me they take from nobody else in the whole faculty of teachers like me, because they're the only one who came out of the shops.
So you must have gotten into the theme of union bureaucracy.
Yeah, and they knew how to talk about this without talking about, without mentioning names. And these guys already, people are generally very intelligent, and they know how to survive, and so they stay away from risky. And if anybody talks too much in the class about this stuff, they pull him aside or her aside, and they clue him in. Hey, you got to talk about it, but not talk about it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, not air
the only time that I had to. The times that were the bad times for the teaching were the summer courses when all the bureaucrats were around. And weekend conferences were the crappiest experiences of all, because then for sure there were bureaucrats hanging out. So I always had to endure those things. But taught every single local that was an AFSCME local in Illinois. I had met these new rebels who were leading Illinois AFSCME, who had just knocked the old union leaders out. And they saw what I was able to do, so we set up a special course. I would go to every local in the state, AFSCME local, twice for openers. And I would do informal work groups and Constitution Bill of Rights. The first effect of it was that the union staff who were hearing all this with regularity organized their own union. And when they were questioned by the guys who had hired me, they said, and they quoted chapter and verse of the U.S. Constitution. And the union leadership got me in, the state leadership, and said, you son of a bitch, you got us. Now with a staff union we got to deal with, collective bargaining, the whole thing, we're like our employers. But, said Larry Reinhold, at least we know where these guys are. They will talk to us now. Before we had no dialogue with them. Now they've got a union, we got a dialogue going, and it's much better all the way around, really and truly. So that was, it seemed, a plus.
Who organized the union staff workers?
Themselves. Into a staff union for just that state, that place, that time. It was a federal, independent local.
Federal local.
Yeah, yeah. There were a couple of other incidents. I can't think of them right now. They weren't important. The machinist was one of the most conservative bureaucracies to deal with. I am. And the international education director, whose name I've forgotten, had been a Trotskyite in the 30s. And he wanted me to send him a write him a long letter on what the course was going to be like and what was going to be in it. And my own director of the course at the institute asked me to send a particular additional paragraph that he liked, that I had written some from somewhere else. And the guy who is the head of the machinist education said, that's subversive. And I didn't teach the course. I mean, they really become bad, you know.
So he kept the machinist locals from sending people to the program.
Oh, I said I don't want anything to do with it under these conditions, and we got somebody else on the staff to do it. But it was really and truly the ideas of my director that got me knocked out, and he refused to own up to it. He said, I have to keep myself free of this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you better keep out of curricula, because you're hurting me. And He understood.
At this time, late 60s, were blacks involved in union leadership or taking these courses in the same numbers?
Well, I didn't have a lot of experience at that time to compare with, you know, I wasn't there in the 50s, in the early 60s, so that I could compare. I knew that particularly from Chicago locals, we were getting a lot of black workers, men and women, who had not participated in unions before. But there's a constant turnover in stewards around the entire country, a tremendous turnover. So I really can't answer whether or not it meant that we were seeing more. Many more. I remember that people said there are more now, but how many more, I don't know.
In proportion to population, though, probably.
There was more, but how many more, we don't know.
The during your travels around, that was an era where there were a lot of riots and things like that. Did you notice any?
We had in Cairo. We had the white hats, who were black guys, who were shooting at the sheriffs, and there was gun battles in the town constantly. all during, well, it must this have been 1971, something like that. I would drive into the town. Here I am with a university car with a big state sticker on it, you know, decal on it.
Looks like a cop, huh?
Yeah. And I met this AFSCME local in a housing project. Sort of a social room of a housing project. And the first thing that was said was the president said, well, we best go ahead and start. Even though it's still five minutes to, because there was the gunfire over there again tonight, and they'll have heard about it over in this town over there where they're coming from, so they won't come tonight. And when we left, when the class was over, everybody fled. They got out of there in an instant. The place cleaned out. 30 stewards just gone. The president said, can I help you out with your stuff? And I had an easel and a moving picture projector and machine and so on. And he held it up like it was a shield for him, you know. He carried out my easel with the big paper pad on it, set it down against my car and got his car and burned rubber.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I was just left there, you know, and I kind of left. But when I pulled into the, in Cairo, that was a jumping-off place for young Northerners who are going to go join the Confederates to go to Cairo and then across the river and down into the South. Matter of fact, in Alton, Illinois, they buried the veterans, their veterans who were Union soldiers on a little island out in the Mississippi, and the Confederate guys are in town in cemeteries. It's a strange part of Illinois. Southern Illinois is very different. But what was I saying? Oh, when I drove into the motel in Cairo, there were all these cars with two antennae on them. And when I got out of the car, shades went open a crack in about six windows in different cabins in the motel. And it was all FBI. I was the only non-FBI person, I was told by the night clerk, in the whole motel. And they had boycotted all the stores in Cairo. They did all their shopping, these black people, at a town 4 or 5 miles away.
What was going on in Cairo?
There was some kind of civil rights movement. I don't know now. I knew then, but I've forgotten the precise nature of.
But blacks evidently wanted access to. Was Cairo itself a segregated town?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Very.
Have you stayed in touch with students after they would? Did they ever have anyone get back in touch with you?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's about a half a dozen, two in particular, both black, who phone me about 3 to 4 times a year. They're still presidents of locals, or chairmen of the shop committee, or chief stewards, things like that, or they're fighting the international.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll phone to discuss something with me, just to use me as a backstop.
Mm-hmm. At this time, you're living in, is it Champaign?
Well, I lived in Urbana, but the university was in the building. Town, the border between the two towns goes right to the campus, so I was, really, it's one city.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in Urbana, and I worked in the university building I was in Champaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Mary was going to school also at this time.
Yeah, she was teaching there.
Well, what was she teaching?
Early childhood education.
To what level? What grade level was she?
There's no. Well, she was teaching it to graduate students who were. She had gotten her PhD and was a professor of early childhood education.
And how are the kids doing at this time?
Well, Lori was having a magnificent experience. That is, she was, here's a town, you didn't have to lock your door anywhere. You didn't have to lock your car. She had a marvelous social life. And, our house would fill up on a Saturday night with 20 high school children. Kids, not children. And she was active in the theater there. And so the cast of a play would come over, the whole cast, and things like that. It was good. Kim, who was a little older, didn't have that kind of good socialization experience. She came when she was already in the 10th grade or something like that. And, she felt an outsider in this town. She could have handled life in Washington, D.C., where we had been the year before, and did handle it well.
Champagne a little too slow for her, huh, at that age?
It might have been. That might have been it. I don't know. It's hard to say just precisely what was going on. But she went through